This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Derek Jensen, who's the author of a new novel called Lives Less Valuable. Hey, Derek, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. I'm glad to talk to you today. Now, Lives Less Valuable is a novel I'd say it's a political novel, but maybe you could talk a little bit about the story without giving away anything to people who haven't read it, but kind of give a little summary of what it's about.
Okay, well, the novel is basically about, the primary character is a person who is kind of like me, except female, in that she is a paper revolutionary, by which I mean that she recognizes that the system is really messed up and that the political system is, you know, entirely corrupt and serves the rich, and she herself is, you know, primarily doing above ground work. And in this book, she is an activist who works for an organization called Council Against Toxics, and it basically is doing, you know, anti-poison work in an inner city that is heavily poisoned by industry. And one night she and early in the book, she's, you know, it's set up that she does recognize that the system is entirely messed up. And partway through the book, she's on her way home from work late one night, and she gets mugged at a bus stop. And she's a way she's different than me as a person. She's a lot more combative. And so as she's getting mugged, she basically says to the muggers, you know, what are you doing? You know, you think you're such big men because you can beat up a woman. And she says, why do you think I'm down here? You know, do I look like I belong in this neighborhood? I'm down here working, trying to stop the toxic in this neighborhood. What she doesn't know is that one of them's little sister recently died of cancer. And once again, this is not giving away stuff. This is all stuff that people learn pretty early. And, one of the mugger's little sisters recently died of cancer. It's really messing with him. So the point is that he that disturbs him greatly when she says that, and he thinks about killing her, but he doesn't. And then he goes back and he really thinks about what she said, and he talks to his brother who's in the penitentiary, and his brother says, you know, she's right. She's, you know, you have all this unfocused anger, basically. And what he says is, you know, you take a bullet and you put it on a table, and you take some gunpowder and you put it on the table and you light it. All you have is a stink in your house and a gunpowder burn on your table. But if you put that gunpowder behind a bullet and you aim it, you got something. His point is, you got to aim your anger. So then one night, several months later, the woman is working at her office late, and the guy shows up, and she says, you know, get the hell out of here. And he says, you know, I came to apologize. I said, fine, apology accepted, now leave. He said, well, we did it. I said, we did what? What are you talking about? And he said, we kidnapped him. He's out in the trunk. And what they did is that they kidnapped the CEO of the corporation and put him in the trunk and brought him to her. And the point is that she's now faced with this dilemma. If she tells him to leave, then she's recognizing that all of her rhetoric all along has been nothing but rhetoric. And if she allows him to stay and participates in dealing with whatever they do with this guy, then she's participating in a capital crime. And so that's basically the central dilemma that I wanted to put the main character in.
Right. So she has a moral dilemma at the same time as she has a kind of self-examination political dilemma, which I think, you know, I think there's a really interesting point there for probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who have done political work, tried to make change, and maybe have felt that they weren't doing enough.
Oh, and that's one of the things also is, I don't know about you, but, I mean, the people, when I've talked about this at talks, when I've talked about this general plot, I mean, this plot is basically the fantasy of, you know, as you said, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of activists across the country. Like, we want to grab these guys and put them on trial. And so in some ways, I heard it said a long time ago that first novel, it's actually my second novel or third novel if you include my graphic novel, but I've heard it said that first novels are usually thinly veiled novels of revenge, where you're, you know, just writing, you know, getting revenge on people who've done you wrong. And
right, your third grade teacher or something. Like,
yeah, exactly. My novel Songs of the Dead, the serial killer's name, and this is not giving anything away, the serial killer's name is Jack Shoemaker, and he's called that because when I was circulating my book A Language Older Than Words before it got published, I got a really nasty rejection letter from this editor named Jack Shoemaker. So it's like, I save that. You know, don't ever mess with a writer because they're going to get back at you somehow 10 years later. This is the fantasy that so many activists have had. And, you know, what would happen if this fantasy actually came to life? What would you do?
Right, and it is, you put her in a very difficult position, and I think we shouldn't talk about what happens, even though it is, you know, clearly at the core of the novel, and it isn't something that you hide from. You know, there isn't a mystery that gets resolved at the end, but I think it's, you don't want to give away too much of how the story unfolds, but clearly she is... and her name is Malia.
Right.
I think I pronounced it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
She's the daughter of the two small farmers,
mm-hmm,
who raise honey, and there's all kinds of, or raise bees for honey, and it's, you know, you have some other interesting characters in there that, you know, kind of counterpoint her, which is, for one, is the guy who runs the organization that she works for, who is even more... I mean, he does sort of fit a stereotype, I guess, but he's the guy who really doesn't want to cause any real ripples to occur. He's too afraid.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things I want to mention about the two things you said there. One is that I wanted to give her a reasonably happy childhood because sometimes people will say, oh, you know, the people who want to fight back, it's just because they have their own personal issues. And I wanted to separate that and give her a reasonably happy childhood, which is one of the reasons I went into the past the way I did, went into her childhood, to show that she's a reasonably well-adjusted and happy person. And then the other character that you mentioned, he, in my mind, he makes the argument that we need to, that the system can be made to work. And he represents... He doesn't represent. I mean, he's actually a lot of people I've known too, in terms of. It's so interesting that if you talk to them in public, then they do say how the system will work. But if they get their defenses down, a lot of times they're far more cynical. The people who, you know, argue very vociferously for, you know, don't ever step outside the lines, a lot of times they are. Once again, if you get them in a more candid moment, they're far more cynical. I remember when I was doing my years and years ago, I met this person at a workshop I did. I mean, at a conference I was at, and she was very, you know, I was talking about how we're in the midst of an apocalypse, and she was very upset by what I was saying and was arguing against, you know, this culture being so destructive, very vociferously and very, I thought, unfairly. And then I did a talk in her community later, and she happened to come to my talk, and we were talking, we went out to dinner beforehand, and at the dinner, it ends up that, you know, she was even more pessimistic about the future than I, which I didn't really think was possible. And I've seen that a lot, where people will argue so strongly for staying within the lines, in part because they're so afraid of looking at examining their own despair. And that's one of the things I wanted to do, is that Malia, I think, is very much in touch with her own despair.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting the way that fiction works in the context of sort of a discourse. You know, I was thinking about the difference between fiction and nonfiction. In nonfiction, it is much more of a telling, even though you might be engaged in a kind of Socratic dialogue intellectually. There is an expository nature to it, whereas in fiction, the characters can represent different sides of the argument and in this kind of... in a more imaginative way. And so you're able here to present a kind of pantheon of responses to the current situation, including the person who is the villain, if we want to call him the villain. You know, he's the representation of the corporate entity. And you paint him as, you know, he's a human being. He's not a stick figure.
He's a good guy. I wanted to really make Larry Gordon, the CEO. By the way, I named him after Larry Craig and Slate Gordon, two awful senators from the Pacific Northwest. Anyway, or former senators, in one case at least. And anyway, I wanted to make him to show that, you know, he's not some Hannibal Lecter. He's just, you know, he's a family guy, and he has, even to the very end, he has absolutely no idea that there's anything wrong with what he's doing, because all he's doing is maximizing revenue and making jobs, and the fact that this is poisoning the area is, it just really doesn't enter his consciousness. You know, he's good to his children, he's not, and I wanted to do that really on purpose, to show that he doesn't have to, you don't have to be, I mean, you can be a good German and participate in these awful situations. And I want to mention one other thing too about some other characters that there's the three muggers. There's Duan, Ray Ray, and Simon. And Duan and Ray Ray are African American, and you know, the book went through probably, oh gosh, 8 or 9 drafts, which is not how I usually work. But the reason I went through there were a bunch of reasons I went through so many drafts, but one of them was, up until the very last draft, those Duan and Ray Ray were of indeterminate race, because I felt extremely uncomfortable writing an African-American character. And I didn't know what to do about that, whether to continue to make them indeterminate or what. And finally I decided that was pretty sort of the coward's way out, to not make them a specific race. So what I did is I put out a call to some people I know to see if there would be some African Americans who would essentially write those characters for me, because once again I didn't feel comfortable with the cultural appropriation. I also didn't feel comfortable with writing something that I so clearly don't know. And there's somebody hooked me up with this really good, very good writer, former con, or ex-con, his name's Duan, and that character's name was Eddie, I think, before, and Duan actually wrote a good part of, you know, I had what they did, but he wrote a lot of the dialogue for me.
Well, that's an interesting, you know, I think actually that's a really interesting point to talk about, because what it does is essentially change the nature of the writing experience in a fiction to make it a kind of collaborative vehicle.
Well, and I did the same thing with some other scenes too, like, and this is once again not giving anything huge away, but Simon is a crack addict, and I've never used any recreational drugs, so I sent out calls again for some crack addicts to write those scenes for me, ex-crack addicts.
Well, they're actually, those are really good. I mean, I've never done crack either, so I have no idea for real, but they were very evocative, really powerful scenes.
I will pass that on to the people who helped, because, you know, I had no idea. Or there's a scene, and once again, not giving anything away, there's a scene where Ray Ray helps his cousin to die. His cousin's dying of cancer, and he helps him to die, and first it got him hooked on a street drug and then overdosed. And once again, this is not a huge plot point, but I originally wrote that scene in one of the early drafts when I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, Supermax here in Crescent City. And when I asked my students, I'm so ignorant on this, and I said, so, you know, what street drug would they hook him on, morphine? And when I said that, one of my students put his hands up in the air, and he put his fingers into a square to show that I was such a square and such a, you know, I knew nothing. And so then what I did, and this is a pretty interesting thing too, the way I did it with the crack, with the ex-crack addicts, and then also with the with this scene, is I had one set of people help me to write that scene. What they said is, no, it won't be morphine, it'd be tar heroin. and I have no idea. And so they told me what it smells like. They told me what it, you know, what it looks like, what it, and then I wrote it up, and I read it to them, and they said, no, 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 you still don't have it. And then I, you know, they helped me fix it again, and then I read it back to them, and I said, no, you still don't have it. And then I read it back to them again, said, okay, you got it. And then once they had done that, I took it to a different group who had never heard it, and I read it to them because I didn't want to read them the crap version and then read them the good version later because then they'd know what's coming. And so when I read them the good version, it was great because they all, you know, they started rocking back and forth and they said, man, this gives me chills. You know, you have a whole different life we didn't know about, Derek. And once again, that came because other people really helped me with those scenes.
No, I think that's important because it, you know, it's a form of research, but it's also a way of entering into this other experience.
Mm-hmm.
And of, I think that's important. If you're gonna, you know, if you're gonna write fiction, you've gotta, you, as you said, you have to know something about what you're talking about. I think it's not necessary to be somebody else in order to write from their perspective, but you've got to at least be able to understand what their experiences are.
And there's so many little lines that can just, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but so often, say in films, if one of the main characters knows something or does something that you know a lot about, a lot of times, like, that just doesn't ring true. And a movie that was actually quite different from that, years and years ago, this has nothing to do with this book, but the movie Yuli's Gold.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which I didn't think was all that great a movie. But, man, you know, I used to be a beekeeper, and they nailed the beekeeping scenes.
Oh, that's really interesting. So the honey and beekeeping in this book is something that you actually know, you do know something about.
Oh, I was a commercial beekeeper for 10 years.
Oh, really interesting. Well, I think actually, you know, in a lot of fiction and a lot, or at least in film, the statement would be made by the people making the film that they make it less than realistic because they need to save time or there's a certain amount of shorthand that they have to do they always say for dramatic purposes.
Right.
And of course, if you know the details of the experience, it's very often frustrating because they don't reflect the reality. But, you know, they're not trying to. They're trying to give it a kind of other version.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty good, I mean, that's a good argument about the nature of fiction, I think. You know, should it be realistic or should it be evocative? And how much of reality can you sacrifice in order to make your point, essentially?
Well, and obviously we are sacrificing reality by the choices we make anyway, in terms of, you know, I don't show any characters defecating at any point in the book.
Right.
And, you know, we leave off. Have you read, by the way, Jasper Ford's Thursday Next series?
You know, I must confess, I tried to read Jasper Ford, and I just couldn't get anywhere with it.
Huh.
I gave up. I don't know why.
Like a month ago, and I liked them. But the point here is that, well, it doesn't matter since we haven't read them and we're not actually talking about those books. But I found them pretty interesting, the notion that the characters in books are real. And that you can, you know, walk into a book and then, you know, those characters, they never get headaches or they never, you know, they have a lot of tea, but they don't eat a lot of meals or something.
Right. Well, and you can, I think that actually is, I mean, I can relate to that idea. I find it kind of intellectually exciting. And people who have done comic books have kind of had that fantasy too, that the line between our reality and the reality of the people who live in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
Is a line you can cross. So you sort of imagine yourself entering that unreal world of the imagination. And that can be a lot of fun. But
mm-hmm.
It's, to me, that's more entertaining than, you know, kind of intellectually stimulating, but
right.
But maybe and kind of interesting for a sort of postmodern thinking about fiction, too. But let me go back and ask one. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to get a sense of your feeling about how the fiction fits into your work, because obviously you've written many books that are nonfiction. You're probably better known for that.
Mm-hmm.
I love your writing. I've found your ideas are just incredibly powerful, and I, you know, I'm a big fan of your writing.
Well, thank you.
But I'm curious to know how what it is that spurred you to write fiction in the context of maybe the arc of your nonfiction work.
Well, I actually got my MFA in creative writing was actually in fiction. And I wrote fiction before I wrote nonfiction, and I wrote a novel in 1987, 1988 that was rejected by 112 publishers, never got published, and then moved over toward nonfiction. And my nonfiction, I don't know if you've noticed this stylistically, but my nonfiction is deeply, deeply influenced by film. That, you know, how I will start to tell one story, stop, and tell another story, and then come back to the first story, and so on. That's really just jump cutting. That's stolen straight from cinema. And so my nonfiction has always been very deeply influenced by, you know, sort of fictional storytelling techniques anyway.
Well, it's true. I can see that definitely in your nonfiction. That makes sense to me.
And then, you know, of course, the advantage of fiction is, I'm sorry, the advantage of nonfiction is that you get to just speechify wherever you want. And, you know, you can just stop and say, well, you know, here's what I'm thinking about this right now. And that's more, you know, that's not really acceptable in fiction. But that's something else that I'm so glad we're having this conversation. For one of the reasons is that one of my peeves with a lot of sort of the modern fictional aesthetic is that so often if it's polemical fiction, that's considered to be a bad thing. Or, you know, if you want to send a message, then, you
right.
know,
higher Western Union.
Exactly. But that's always really bugged me because, I mean, hello, Leo Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Charles Dickens. It's just, you can still send a message. It just has to be, you know, I was really heavily influenced by John Gardner's essay on moral fiction, which was written in the 80s.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he was making essentially this same point. I was, you know, I was a very young writer at that point. I hadn't, you know, I was, you know, sort of a quote writer because I was saying I was a writer, but I wasn't really doing much writing yet. I was still gathering. But that was really deeply influential for me, where he was saying, you know, people write what they feel strongly about. And a lot of, you know, modern or postmodern fiction is about some college professor who's going to therapy and having sex with a student, you know, and that's because that's what that particular writer knows. But then he wrote about Germinal, and he contrasts that with Germinal, which is this extraordinary book about a coal mine in France that and a strike, and it's incredibly powerful. And the reason that he could write that book is because, you know, he had visited a coal mine, and he got the incredibly moving scene about the horse that's lowered down as a colt and then lives its whole life in the coal mine. That's because when he was there, he saw those horses that lived their whole lives down in coal mines. And I mean, I was sobbing so much when I read that book. And so one of the things that fiction can do, well, okay, it doesn't matter whether it's fiction or nonfiction, part of what writing is supposed to do is to transport us to that world and to transport us, to move us. And one of the things I want to do is, you know, we were talking before about what this book is about intellectually, but I also wanted for people to get really caught up with Malia and care emotionally what happens to her. I mean, you know, her life is not in a good way when the book starts. And, you know, is she going to end up, is her life going to get worse? Is it going to get better? And, you know, I want people to care about the characters and to, It's kind of this middle ground because I really love, I mean, I hate to say this, but, okay, I really love reading, you know, those classics. You know, Thomas Hardy moves me, except I wish that sometimes he would have one book that ended happily. And, you know, Joseph Conrad, all those classics so often. I love those. And then at the same time also, you know, I have to admit that one of the things that I do, and this is the thing that's embarrassing, is one of the main things that I read if I'm, you know, going to do a talk or just for fun, is I read mysteries, and I read, like, well-written suspense
yeah.
stuff. And what I would really like to do, and I'm still working on this, is to write like those classic writers where you get a really good moving plot. I mean, that's the thing, is I don't like reading fiction where I'm reading along and I don't care what happens. I want to read fiction where I stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning because I want to know what happens next.
Right, so I think that's sort of the power of fiction in telling a story. And of course, one of the difficulties of, and I think politically, the idea of a politically engaged novel. It's been a bit of a problem because there have been so few that have been able to tell a great story, at least, you know, in our lifetime. I think the power has been in the nonfiction side in terms of political engagement.
I totally agree, and that's something that I would really like to keep working on. I mean, I've got, 15 books out or so, and 12, so essentially two novels, a graphic novel, and, you know, 12 other books, or 12 nonfiction books. And so I'm obviously much younger as a fiction writer than a nonfiction writer. And I can carry over some of the skills, obviously, but others I still have to learn. So I consider myself as a fiction writer still pretty young. And I'm doing a nonfiction book right now, and when I finish this, the next three projects that I want to do are all fiction. And I want to become better and better. And they're all political fiction. And I want to continue to try to... I mean, once again, Joseph Conrad did it, you know?
So did John Steinbeck. I was thinking about, you know, that is a great example for us, and it's not that far in the past.
And have you read his book, Burning Bright, I think it is?
Yeah, long, long time ago.
Okay, I hated that book. And one of the reasons, well, I didn't hate it, it was very young. And it's like his second or third novel or something. And it's pretty heavy-handed, and you can tell that he's a very young writer. It's like, you know, it's like Pink Floyd's first albums or something.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't have the elegance and... What's the word I'm looking for? Where you're...
Well, the ease, you know, the sort
Thank
of
you.
Where you can't see the wheels and levers moving. That sort of, you know, that kind of smoothness to the writing and to the plot, I think. That's sort of what you gain, I think. You know, most writers, I think it's true to say that most writers, as you learn how to write a novel, it becomes less mechanical or less noticeable how the pieces fit together.
Well, thank you. That's perfect, because the one part that I remember of Burning Bright is that the one thing that has always stuck with me in 25 years since I read it or whatever is it starts off with this character in a hotel room, and there's a neon sign that's lighting through the window, and the neon sign's red, and I go, oh, okay, the guy's a communist. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it was such a mechanical, and I love what you said about ease. It was just a forced image, a very young image.
Well, you've made me want to go back and look at that book, and because I think it is really interesting to think about, you know, whether when you read a novel, you don't notice that you're being moved with it to another place, which is what you talked about before about being transported.
Mm-hmm.
The more you don't notice, and the kind of then the you know maybe that becomes the way that you are engaged without knowing it, that you've been kind of seduced by the novel, and I think that's really a powerful thing.
Yeah, and I've got a question for you, which is, and this is something I'm trying to work out, and I think I have an answer for, which has to do with, you know, real capital T thrillers. A lot of times they move really, really fast. And I'm wondering, but one of the things that seems often missing with the capital T thrillers is serious character development. And I'm wondering if character development almost inherently makes a novel move a bit more slowly, but it's richer.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I'm a good enough critical reader of fiction to be able to answer that. But my guess is that I don't think it's necessary, but I think I can see why it would happen more times than not. In other words, that someone would sacrifice the character for the story, because story is what people really respond to. You can see that, I think, with the Dan Brown books. The characters are not meaningful in any way. And what people love is the story and the kind of elements that you know that are built the kind of building of the fantasy is, it doesn't have anything to do with the characters.
Right.
They're more stick figures that are used to move the story along. And that seems to be, maybe that's because people are so used to watching movies where it's all about the action and driving the story forward and kind of bringing people along in order to get to the entertaining end.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that with really good writing, and I think I'm just validating your point too, that with really good writing you can bring them both back where you can. I think about the start of the movie Deliverance, where, you remember the dueling banjos scene?
Yeah, yeah.
And then that end, you know, at the end of the dueling banjos scene, the Ned Beatty character says one line that lets you know everything you need to know about the character, which is when this incredibly moving scene is done, Ned Beatty says to the guy who'd been playing the guitar, flip him a couple of bucks.
And
my point is that developed Ned Beatty's character without slowing the story.
Right.
Because they were able to have the perfect line. And if you're not as experienced a writer, you know, it might take you five pages of background description to get to that one perfect line. And if you're going a different direction and you're not such a great writer, you can also have Ned Beatty not do such a great line and move the story forward without developing a character.
Right, which shows how hard it is to be a great writer. You know, I want to say I think that you've done a great job with this book, and you know, I think it is very difficult, and I think you've overcome a lot of the impediments that exist for writers in writing a book that has an underlying message, if you will, and a story that is it's not just an entertainment. It has it has ideas in it that you want people to think about. I think they're really important ideas, so I really hope people will read this book.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I wasn't worried about getting the ideas across. I knew I'd be able to do that. The thing I was hoping it would be is entertaining. And I got a note from a friend of mine maybe 2 weeks ago cursing at me for writing this book, because he said that he stayed up too late and didn't sleep the previous two nights because he was finishing the book.
Right, that's a great thing to hear from a reader.
It made me really happy.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for talking to me, Derek. This has been David Wilk talking to Derek Jensen for Writer's Cast. We've been talking about his novel, Lives Less Valuable, and I recommend that book to everyone. Thanks so much.
Thank you.